So coming up next is our audiobook review of Lessons in Chemistry. The book has been very kindly supplied to us by Calibre Audio, who provide audiobooks totally free to anyone with sight disability. If you want to find out more, visit their website www.calibre.org.uk. The quotes from the book you will hear during the review are read by Jennifer Grant and are not from the actual audio recording supplied by Calibre, but I think you'll agree that Jen does an amazing job with the text. But first, here's a brief synopsis of the book. As the novel opens in 1961, Elizabeth Zott is a 30-year-old single mother and is the reluctant star of a cooking show for housewives called Supper at Six. Trained as a research chemist, Elizabeth worked for the Hastings Research Institute, but her academic career has floundered, despite her obvious talent. The story jumps back 10 years, and then we start to understand why. Female scientists are viewed with suspicion by their male colleagues. From her earliest undergraduate days, Elizabeth has been subject to attacks on her reputation and her person, from major sexual assault and theft of her work to casual everyday misogyny meted out by people, including other women, who see her independence and single-mindedness as a threat. Even when she finds her soulmate, the Nobel-nominated chemist Calvin Evans, her happiness is short-lived. Elizabeth's unusual approach to cooking is a revelation to the audience, and the programme becomes hugely popular. Using her platform to speak directly to millions of housewives, Elizabeth initiates a quiet revolution about their own capacity for change. I asked Debbie Heath to join me in the studio last week to review this book, and you may remember Debbie, who partnered Rob to review audiobooks in previous editions of this programme. But just as a reminder, Debbie is a playwright, musician, teacher, and also a journalist for the St Albans Times. Welcome, Debbie.
Oh, it's lovely to be back. Nice to do a review with you, Marley.
So, Lessons in Chemistry. Debbie, what did you think?
I think it's a fascinating book. It was introduced to me by a friend who said this is a really good bit of feminist literature, which immediately interested me. But I don't want that to put off any gentleman listening either, because it's a fascinating glimpse into life and gender stereotypes in the 1950s and onwards. This is an American book, but I think that most of these issues apply to us in the UK as well. And what it's really looking at is something that's in the news a lot at the moment. It's about the role of women in science and in male-dominated roles, and how they've been the unsung heroes. And our heroine, Elizabeth, was a chemist who couldn't get a PhD because of something very bad that happened at the hands of a man. And she has been fighting her way up through the ranks to try and be regarded as a chemist rather than a secretary, which I think that role was forced on her at one point, wasn't it?
Yes, I have a quote I think we might use at this stage.
She saw herself living in such a society, a place that didn't always automatically mistake her for a secretary, a place where, when she presented her findings in a meeting, she didn't have to brace herself for all the men who would invariably talk over her, or worse, take credit for her work.
In addition to being a very good scientist, she is also ends up in motherhood. It was a bit of a surprise to her, wasn't it?
Yeah. The structure of the book, he starts sort of in the present day for her, which is the 1960s, and then jumps back to the 1950s, as I understand it.
Yes.
And kind of explains how she got to where she is. We first meet her when she's presenting a TV programme that she's quite reluctant to do, but despite her reluctance, becomes a great success at it. I hope I'm not giving too much away.
No, I think that's fine. It really is very interesting. Elizabeth is unusual in that she was an unmarried mother, something that the TV station have asked her to keep quiet.
She is an unmarried mother, and she's quite unconventional for her time, isn't she? And could say we have to say, as you mentioned, her feminist beliefs are quite strong for that time. And it's her kind of stoicism, I think, that although awful things happen to her throughout the book, she never seems to become a victim from them. She seems to survive them, and her determination is quite extraordinary.
She is inspiring and she is outspoken, and this is not what people expect women to be. For instance, it's quite unusual for a mother to challenge the father of one of her daughter's classmates in such a direct way as this. So let's listen to our quote.
"Mr. Pine," she said in a more conciliatory manner, "I'm sorry I don't have the time or resources to make your daughter lunch. We both know food is the catalyst that unlocks our brains, binds our families, and determines our futures, and yet..." She trailed off, her eyes growing narrow as she took in a soap opera poster featuring a nurse giving a patient some unusual care. "Does anyone have the time to teach the entire nation to make food that matters? I wish I did, but I don't. Do you?" As she turned to leave, Pine, not wanting her to go or fully understanding what he was about to hatch, said quickly, "Wait, please, just stop, please. What was that thing you just said? About teaching the whole nation how to make food that matters?" Supper at Six debuted 4 weeks later, and while Elizabeth wasn't entirely keen on the idea, she was a research chemist, she took the job for the usual reasons. It paid.
Yes, because like it or not, Elizabeth did need the money as a single parent. I hadn't really considered before how program scheduling works in TV, and particularly in terms of the hierarchy in the television system. Mm. I think it's absolutely fascinating what it reveals.
As some listeners might know, my career was mostly in the television industry. I probably started about 30 years ago. And as a sort of newcomer to the industry, I think attitudes that are reflected in the book were still around. The quote that really stands out for me was when Walter says to Elizabeth,
"Elizabeth," he said, "this is a job. You have two duties, to smile and read cue cards. That's it. You don't get to have an opinion about the set or the cards."
One of the issues they talk about is how, with our circadian rhythms, we are supposed to have a siesta after lunch and obviously go to sleep at night. And due to our busy lives, we don't take that siesta that apparently our bodies need. And the idea is that at that period in the afternoon, nothing terribly useful can be done.
There is another quote here, which I can probably sums it up.
Yeah.
Walter says, when Elizabeth's in the studio, she's not particularly happy with the setup and what her script is. So Walter Pine says,
"It's our job to give people what they want, even if they don't know they want it. I explained this. It's the afternoon programming model. Half dead, now awake, you know." "Another ad," the cameraman whispered. "Unnecessary," she said quickly. "Sorry, everyone, I'm ready now." "We're on the same page, aren't we?" Walter called as she made her way back on stage. "Yes," Elizabeth said. "You want me to speak to the average Jane, the normal housewife." He didn't like the way she said it.
It's meant to be background wallpaper sort of TV, as I understand it. Not too challenging. Nothing that might sort of like get you out of your stupor. And it's aimed at housewives, who he then calls the average Jane, the normal housewife. So you can get the attitude of the time, which I think possibly hasn't changed that much. If you do catch afternoon TV, it does tend to be a little bit on the slow side.
Well, I'm too busy, Marnie.
Me too. I feel it's probably progressed a bit, and some of these programmes have been replaced by quiz programmes. But the idea that don't challenge your audience, don't do anything controversial in the afternoon is still the same idea. I'm hoping we've got away from the average Jane and the normal housewife.
But I think Elizabeth really did want to challenge women. She wanted to use her programme to make women think about what they're doing, to really celebrate the science. And she really pushed to be able to wear a white coat. But the TV studio, seeing that she is a very beautiful woman, put her in very tight clothes, which she didn't like. But she wanted to be taken seriously, and she encouraged her watchers to be taken seriously. And starts a mini revolution, really, doesn't she?
She does. And the fact that she'll only use scientific terms. So she describes vinegar as acetic acid, and she describes salt as sodium chloride. Walter seems to be sort of slightly concerned that the audience won't understand it. And her kind of idea is, yes, let's challenge them a little bit. I'm sure if they don't understand, they'll look it up. And as you say, this proves to be very popular.
It does. But despite the friction between Elizabeth and Walter, a genuine friendship blossoms between the two of them, and they become, you know, a great source of support for each other over the course of the book. And that's really lovely, because at first, and I have heard this as a criticism of the book, that Elizabeth isn't a warm enough, relatable person. Now, yes. I really did like her.
Yes, I did too.
I liked her zestiness. There's just something very direct and fun about her. But I think that through her relationship with Walter and through another character, Harriet, some really important friendships develop. And there were others as well. So you can see that she is a relatable person. And I hope that if anyone is put off at the beginning of the book, they will persevere. And talking of friendships, is now a good time to bring up the character of 630.
Yes. Now, this is quite unusual for a book it's fiction, but it doesn't have any kind of fantasy in it. And 630, not to give too much away again, but 630 is not a talking dog, he's a thinking dog. Mm. And we get to know his thoughts, which is really interesting because it adds another dimension to the novel, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The fact that he has a take on humanity and he comments quite well. But he's also a soulmate and a friend to Elizabeth and Madeline, her daughter. And I really like the character of 630.
Yes, I do as well. Yeah. But we're animal lovers, aren't we?
Yes.
And I talk to all my pets all the time, whether they're a rodent or a cat or whatever. And I'd love to know what they're thinking. And it seems like 630 understands a lot more than that. And it's a really interesting literary device, isn't it?
It is. I really enjoyed it. At first when I thought, hang on, this dog seems to be talking, or all he's thinking, we know his thoughts. I thought, how is this going to work? The author has taken quite a risk doing this.
Yes, absolutely.
Because it's not something you'd normally hear. And he just became part of the narrative, and it didn't seem extraordinary after a couple of thoughts she'd heard from him. So now would probably be a good time to have a couple of thoughts from 630. He makes some comments on the human race, both good and bad. Let's hear what he has to say.
Still, he sensed that most people did not listen to their dogs. This was called ignoring. Or wait, no. Ignorance. He'd just learned that one. By the way, and not to brag, but his word count was up to 497. Say what you want about the human race, their capacity for kindness was what, in 630's opinion, put them over the top species-wise.
It reminds me a little of The Book Thief by Marcus Zusak. Is that his name?
Yeah.
And Death is one of the narrators, which I liked, but my 13-year-old would not read it. He just couldn't get on with that. So it's a personal thing, isn't it?
It is.
It's just really interesting for those of us who've studied literature or just people who like reading when something a little bit different comes along like this. So that really worked for me. I thought it was really fun.
Yeah, it was great.
So if we had to sum up three reasons why people should listen to this book, what would they be for you, Marley?
Ooh, three reasons. Okay. So my first reason is the feminist aspect of the book, which I think we've probably discussed at length, but I really think this book puts a new spin on it and it feels fresh and innovative. The second reason for listening to this book is something we haven't really touched upon earlier, and it's the rowing analogy. Calvin Evans, who's Elizabeth's partner, is a rower and a really, really keen rower. And he introduces Elizabeth to rowing, so much so that even when she's pregnant with Madeline, she goes on the ergometer. And for those of you not familiar with an ergometer, it is a static rowing machine. You quite often see them in gyms. And Elizabeth is asked by her obstetrician, usually, to join his rowing team later on in the book. And I think what Bonnie Garment's trying to say here is that despite all the prejudice and the misogyny that Elizabeth experiences in all the other walks of her life, in the rowing world, she's equal to everybody. Everyone in the boat pulls the same and is the same. And I like the fact that she's found somewhere where she doesn't have to try so hard, where she isn't judged by her sex. And that really works well for me. I think that is a sort of saving grace in the world of complete sexism.
And the author was into rowing herself.
Yes, and I think obviously you can see that the expertise comes through there, that she's been in a boat with other people and, you know, has experienced that exhilaration you get from rowing. And I think 6:30, yeah, 6:30 absolutely does appeal to me. And that whole character has been really interesting.
Yeah, I agree with all three of those points, actually. And I think as a writer myself, if I could add another one, it's just that it's a little bit different. I really like the way the writer has approached a character. I think it's a very well-drawn character. It's challenging in some ways. Some parts of the book are disturbing, but it's also just very warm and very funny. And it really makes you think. I'm still thinking about this book. And it's a great time to read it because there's now a TV adaptation. And I am a firm believer that you should always read the book before you watch a TV or a film adaptation.
I totally agree with that. I think, as we know, TV will always put their own interpretation on it. And I think, yes, if you've read the book first, you then have a firm idea in your mind of the characters and the narrative. And then quite often when you watch the TV series, it's not quite the same.
It's not. But, you know, as partially sighted people, one of our great challenges listening to an audiobook is that it's already someone else's interpretation. And I feel so frustrated about that. Although this reader is absolutely brilliant. So I don't have any complaints about that for this book. But it's sometimes a challenge. But that's our lot. We're very lucky to have the range of audiobooks we have. And Caliber has been absolutely brilliant for me during the early stages of my sight loss. I think we're very lucky to have audiobooks, but that's the only drawback. But yeah, listen to that book or read it if you're able to read before you see the TV adaptation. But it's something everyone's going to be talking about. All the mummy book groups seem to be talking about it at the moment, and people have strong opinions one way or the other. So yeah, find out what your opinion is and pick up a copy.
My thanks to Debbie Heath there for giving us such an expert opinion on Lessons in Chemistry.